Here we are, we're live. Let me just, yep, we are. Hi, everybody. Hi out there. Hi here. How are you all?
Good.
So we're doing Persuasion today, and this is by far my most favourite subject. And the reason it's my most favourite subject is I reckon it's the thing that turns everything. If you can be persuasive and influential, if you can turn the proposition the way you want it to go, then much more of your life is going to go the way that you want it to go. Doesn't matter whether you're a parent or you're running a business or whether you're involved in the sales field or whatever it is, the whole idea of being persuasive and influencing what's going on means that you have a chance of making your activity or your profession or your family life working the way that you want. Most people look at persuasion and influence as relevant to sales, and I would say that that's only a small part of what goes on. But it is easy to do research in the sales field. So a lot of the things I'm going to quote from today are going to be about experiments people have done with large numbers of people. For those of you out there, you would know that I have, you know, over the last few years fallen in love with mega data. I just love the idea that we can grab massive amounts of data and draw conclusions from it, because those conclusions are going to tell us what we actually know or what we actually do rather than what we think we do. For example, if you survey large numbers of people, like, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, I saw one last year that said that 60% of Americans intended to vote. So what they were saying was, at the next presidential elections, I will be voting. 60%. They got a 40% turnout. So what that means is that we think that we are going to do something more than we actually do. That applies in lots of cases. One of the reasons that I realized that I needed to track my visits to the gym was I noticed that I could think that I hadn't been in the gym for a few days. When I looked in the calendar, it was actually a week and a bit. But it felt like to me, it was only like 2 days. So my perception of what was going on and the reality of what was going on were sort of two vastly different things. So the reason I like mega data is it tells us what's actually happening rather than what we think is happening. And it allows us to predict reliably what might happen in transactions or situations or whatever. So we're going to look at some mega data and some research and draw conclusions from that. Like I said, that's most easily done in the sales area, but you should not interpret what we're saying as today is about sales. But I am going to talk about making the sale, because if you fall in love with someone and you want them to marry you, the chances are you're going to have to make a sale. Man, woman or child, you're going to have to make that sale. If you don't make the sale, then if you can't put a proposition that works, then the chances are that's not going to work. If you want the 14-year-old to empty the dishwasher, you're probably going to have to make that sale. If you want to convince your family to go here on holidays instead of there on holidays, you're going to have to make that sale. Does that make sense to you guys in the room? It's kind of like it's a sale. There is not the traditional you get a product and I get some money. There is a how do we make this work so that we get what looks best for all of us. So we're going to talk a lot about win-win and how you make a sale where the person who buys, whether that's a 14-year-old who figures, you know what, I think I'd rather empty the dishwasher than deal with the consequences of not emptying the dishwasher. When they step into the area of saying, it's to my advantage to do that, then we get a win for everyone. Does that make sense? Okay, so but what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, let's have a look at how you might traditionally do this. In other words, when we've got an idea we want to get across, if you look at typical situations, you know, the politicians will want us to vote for them. So they'll go out and they will kind of start to spruik a message and hope that that message hits a nerve. And basically what they're trying to do is figure out what the population want and then tell them they'll deliver that so that they can get the votes. In other words, politicians work on buying our votes. In other words, if I've got a leaning towards I want bus stops all around here, and to get my vote you've got to be the politician who says we're putting in bus stops, then essentially they use the taxpayer money to buy my vote. In other words, the bus stops are going to cost some money to put in. Does that make sense? So we have a ludicrous system in the political field where mostly politicians buy my vote or your vote with your money, which is a staggering concept when you think about it, and most of us fall for it. Brings in, if you look, say, for example, the recent turnaround in political situation in Australia. So where are we now? June 2019, not very long ago, we had a federal election. Basically, that was swung on what happened in Queensland. If you looked at Queensland, there's a whole lot of people who voted for the Liberal National Party because they were saying they were going to go ahead with the Adani mine and a bunch of other things, and basically people voted for jobs. Interesting concept. That's been reproduced all around the world. So if you look at who voted for Trump, basically it was a bunch of people who were desperate about their jobs. Some of them quite inexplicitly desperate for their jobs. So there were large tracts of America where manufacturing used to take place, and a whole bunch of basically white people who are now white poor people because their jobs vanished 20 years ago. And what most of those people did was sit around saying, it isn't fair, the factory closed down, so the factory that I worked in is not there anymore, so I don't have a job. And for 20 years, those people have not thought about reskilling or changing careers or doing something different. They've just sat around and whinged and moaned about, the manufacturing's gone, it's all I know how to do. I'm just a bricklayer kind of thing. Or I'm just a lawyer in a small town, but there's no lawyering needs done in the small town. And what Trump said was, I'm going to bring manufacturing back. I'm going to make America great again. We'll bring manufacturing back to the US. And all these people said, yeah, beauty, I'm going to get a vote. And by the way, we're going to blame my poor circumstances on all these imports coming through Mexico. So Trump says, I'll put a wall there to stop these people coming in who are taking your jobs, and I'll bring your jobs back. And most people said, okay, spend whatever it takes to get my job back. It would actually be cheaper just to give those people money. But we'll kind of get off the thing. Really what I'm saying is what Trump is selling, or what Trump sold to get elected, was what people wanted already. The trick in persuasion is to find out what people want. Does that make sense? Now, the 14-year-old doesn't want to empty the dishwasher. What we've got to find out is, what do they want more than to not empty the dishwasher? So do they want pocket money? Do they want accolades? Do they want to do it for a week and then get a week off? In other words, if it just comes down to empty the dishwasher or else, that's not really being persuasive or influential. That's just a power play. And what you'll find is power plays don't work with adults. Power plays work if you have the power, but they're useless outside of circumstances where you don't. So most of us need to be able to be persuasive, and we've got to find out what the 14-year-old wants. And if they plainly don't want to empty the dishwasher, then we've got to bring something new into the equation. Does that make sense? Okay. So we've got to sell the idea that emptying the dishwasher is great for you, and you would love to do it because of what happens after that. Does that make sense? Rightio. So I've got an exercise for you to do. For those of you at home, this might be a bit tricky, but see if you can find someone at home to do this with. I'm going to give you a minute to do this. Turn yourselves into pairs, which is going to be difficult. There are 5 people in the room here right now at the moment, so saying turn yourselves into pairs is a bit tricky. So maybe you guys can work together in a group of 3. So one of you grab a pen and the other just empty your hands for a second. So who's got the pen? Over here. Rightio. So, Sarah, you've got the pen, and Angela, you've got the pen. Rightio. So, Ange, you're going to have to sell the pen to Rick. Jen, you can be the observer. Sarah, you've got to sell the pen to Jay. You've got a minute. Ready, set, go. Okay, let's hold it there. Let's see how you went. Did you sell the pen, Ange? Okay, not yet. That's okay. You only had a minute. You're forgiven. Didn't... Yeah, no. in the last second. That's probably because you gave up. Swap the pen over. Righto, whoever's got the pen, you got a minute. Ready, set, go. Sell the pen. June's running an auction. Okay, hold it there. Hold it there. How did you go, Jay? Sell the pen? No, Jen?
Well, she would have, because that was a good idea.
She would have. She would have. Okay, so what was the difficulty? Just what did you come up against? What was the problem? You don't want the pen?
Oh, okay. Sarah, okay. Something definite she could rub out.
Oh, you want a pencil? Okay, so you can rub things out. Okay, cool. Somebody else, why didn't... Sarah, how come you didn't sell the pen? What was the difficulty about selling the pen?
He's a pen king and he has already got a whole heap.
He's got a shitload of pens, all right?
That was going to add to his day and it wasn't impressive enough.
So he's already got a zillion of them. That happens.
Yeah.
Quite often you're in a situation where you're trying to sell something, they've already got heaps of it. These are very common situations where, yeah, you come across someone who's got no interest in what you've got. They've already got plenty of it, or they don't want that. They want a different version. Sarah didn't want a pen. She wants a pencil. Okay, what about over here? How did you guys go? What did you come up against?
My brain wasn't really warmed up yet.
No.
But I hadn't thought about it, then I would have thrown in a free notebook or something to go with the pen.
So buy the pen and you get a free notebook.
Well, yeah, but I didn't think about that then because I went, I'd have to sell a pen.
Yeah. Sometimes they do that. When they're selling Ferraris, what they do is they say, this is a $600,000 motor and the rest of the car's free. Because most people want to buy, sometimes I'll say, this is the body of the Ferrari in traditional Ferrari red, 600 grand for the body, and we'll throw in the motor. Because much use without the motor, so we'll give you one of them for free. In other words, the list price of the thing is 600 grand. So what we do is, why would most people want a Ferrari? You have to think like a Ferrari owner. Why would you want a Ferrari? Prestige, sound, looks good, all that sort of stuff. So you sell the bit that the people want, say that that's the list price and throw in the rest for free. Does that make sense? So why would the 14-year-old want to empty the dishwasher?
So to clean plates for later on to eat everything off?
Well, because if you do it 365 days consecutively, I'll take you to Disneyland.
So when he's out and he's got his partner, he can actually do something like that and she'll be impressed.
Yeah, but he doesn't give a rat's ass about what's going to happen in 6 to 10 years' time.
If you do the emptying of the dishwasher, I'll do the filling.
Meaning?
That worked in our house.
Meaning? Meaning?
Meaning it was an alternative. Which one do you want to do?
What?
So either... fill the dishwasher or empty the dishwasher.
Oh, okay.
What are you
going to
do?
Okay, I thought you meant meaning I'll cook.
Well, no, in our house it was, if you empty the dish, your job's to empty the dishwasher, I'll fill it.
Okay.
So she never had to put anything into the dishwasher, which suited her quite happily, because that was what the standard behaviour was anyway. So I went, okay, you're on empty, I'll put them in.
Okay, cool. It's kind of like, do you want to wash or do you want to wipe?
Yeah.
It's kind of like, we're going to Brisbane.
Because she made the choice, then she owned it too.
When people make the choice, they own it. It's kind of like we're going to Brisbane. You want to go in a car or do you want to catch a bus? The thing we wanted was to get them to Brisbane. Does that make sense? How we're getting to Brisbane? Let's talk about transport options. If you get onto transport options, then what you do is you get the big one out of the way. Does that make sense? It's going to happen. It's just which one do you want, the emptying or the filling? That makes sense? Okay, what other things did you come up against? Because these things are very common. You know, you come across someone who's already got it, or you come across someone who doesn't want it. What else? You come across someone whose brain's not warmed up.
Time.
Time. It was kind of like pretty...
Trying to rush. Trying to get feeling a bit under pressure. Like, yep. Trying to convince someone quickly.
Because why? What does time pressure do to you?
Makes you anxious.
Stops your thinking.
Because you're not relaxed.
Makes you anxious. Makes you make poor decisions. Makes you go to places where you've always gone before. So if you're short of time, if the pressure is on, you'll resort to what worked in the past. So if pushing people around used to work for you, you'll resort to pushing people around. If being cooperative and trying to get consensus worked for you in the past, when the pressure's on, you'll try and get consensus. In other words, the greater the pressure, the further back in your history you will go. Until you find something that worked back there and you'll trot that one out because there's no time to think. There's the apparent sense that by thinking, I'm not going to find something. It's a very difficult thing to imagine what you're going to think of next. You can think of, what am I going to think of next, which is, what am I going to think of next? So what are you going to be thinking of in an hour? We don't know.
Food.
Does that make sense? So the creator... Did you say food? Well, it kind of fits in that category. In as much as, you know, I was a school teacher from 1973 till 1980. So I spent 7 years as a school teacher. Now, 1980 was a fair while ago, wasn't it? How many of you weren't born in 1980? Some of you? Okay. So, that's a fair while ago. But I can still tell you every day when it's 10:30 in the morning, because that's when they used to ring the bell for recess. So I'm a creature of habit, and I still get hungry at 10:30 every morning, regardless of what I've eaten beforehand. So am I really hungry? I couldn't be, not every day. Some days I have eggs for breakfast, some days I have a glass of water, some days I have a cup of coffee, some days it's a massive meal, but at 10:30, boom, off goes the stomach. It does the same thing at 10 minutes to 12, because that's when lunchtime was. So am I really hungry, or do I think I'm hungry?
I think you're hungry.
I think I'm hungry. So I'm Pavlov's dog. Yeah, sometimes I feel like I'm all of his dogs.
But in saying that, has your body set itself and done the processing and everything like that where you actually are? Because it knows it needs to have space to eat at that time.
Well, what my body does is it sends up the sensations of hunger, not based on what I need, based on the emotions of. So if I didn't really like being a teacher, what is 10:30 really?
Break time, yeah.
Me time. What is 10 to 12 really? Me time and relief from all those little mongrels who wanted to mess things up. I've got a woodwork room full of lethal weapons. What I want, what do I really want? I want that room empty. I want no kids in there. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
10 past 3 in the afternoon?
Finish time.
Freedom.
Not hungry.
Yeah, freedom.
Freedom. Completely different sensation. So I can tell you now, still, 10 past 3 in the afternoon, I feel like the day's over.
So I grew up in a rural environment, and it's not time, it's daylight. So
yep.
In winter, you wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning at the earliest. In summer, you wake up at 4 o'clock.
Yeah.
And dinner time is an hour after dark. That's when you're hungry.
That's
not
right. Yep.
At 6 p.m.
And
yeah,
so. Interesting enough, what you do is when you get up is you go. So
yeah.
In the country, you don't get up and have breakfast and a shower and all that sort of stuff. You basically get up and get going.
Yeah, go and feed everybody and then come in to eat.
Then you might come in for breakfast at what might other people might consider a normal time, which might be 7:30, but for you the day is half gone because of, you know, you got up and got going at 4 o'clock.
Yeah.
That make sense? Mm-hmm. So we become creatures of habit. We start to think that this is normal. So your normal becomes real. What that means is if you think it's not right or not normal or not kosher to sell, you'll be uncomfortable selling. If you think that influencing another person's decision is not your right to do that, you'll be uncomfortable when you're trying to influence their decision. Most of us get uncomfortable because of how we feel about the circumstances rather than what the circumstances really are. Does that fit? For most of us, being convincing, being persuasive, influencing things makes us uncomfortable for the vast majority of people. I can tell you the four-letter word in Australia that strikes a fear into the heart of most people, and it's the word sell. Make me do anything, but don't make me sell. Okay, so somebody throw me a pen. Yours would be good, Ange.
That doesn't work, so yeah.
Okay, so who am I selling the pen to?
Me, because they're damn good pens.
Okay, so so you're the guinea pig, Jason. So Sarah, get your stopwatch.
I'll sell it to Sarah. She won't buy. She'll make it hard.
Well, yeah, but you volunteered. So. Reset go?
Mm-hmm.
Rightio, Jay, tell me three things you like about this pen.
Well, I've used them before. I know the style and they have a real good control system and they're easy to handle.
Okie doke. So what would you be prepared to pay for it?
I'll give you a dollar.
Sold.
Sold in 15 seconds.
So what's the difference?
You asked him to identify what he needed.
Mm. I got him to identify what he needed. Bugger this joke about what does a 14-year-old need to empty the dishwasher. Get them to tell you. Bugger this joke about walking in and trying to sell something to somebody. What are you looking for? What do you need? Why are you here? What are we? How can I help you? What's in this for you? We can come up against some pretty difficult things. You see, if that pen cost me $5 and I just sold it for a dollar, we've got a problem. And the problem
but
is...
You didn't have to give it to him for a dollar.
No.
Except that...
Well, we could have started negotiating, but what I wanted to demonstrate is that...
You could sell it.
What happens is we kind of get under pressure, we do what we've always done, and we don't stop and think, hang on, is there a better way? But if you just stop and think, really, then most things are pretty simple. Most things are straightforward. What do you want? What do you want? Is there any way we can make a meeting in the middle? If we can't, then don't worry about it. We're not going to do business today. That's not the end of life. That's not the end of the meaning of life or any of that kind of stuff. The fact that we can't do business today doesn't mean that the world's going to stop rotating on its axis. What we have to do is look at how can we find a place where we can meet somewhere where we're both happy? Does that make sense? Okie doke. So we could have, if I needed $5 for the pen, and I've got, and Jay said he's prepared to pay a dollar, then what would you do? If you're in my situation, what would you do? What would be the next thing? He's at a dollar and I need five. So I really needed eight. How do you feel about that, Jay?
I'm not really interested at eight. I can get them on eBay for four.
Okay, so at four, we'd be doing the business.
Could stretch to that, yeah.
You could stretch to four, okay. So they cost me more than that to buy. So I can't do business with you at four. So is there any way you can find your way to five? Because at five, I could be there.
Oh, I suppose, because mine's about to run out, so I suppose, yeah.
Well, Jay's going to say yes or no, right? But what I'm saying is at five, we're at four, at five, I'm in. really what I'm saying is that for or not. No pen for you, buddy. Now, that may affect him, it may not. He may care or he may not care about no pen. Does that make sense? Okay, so the whole idea here is, what have you noticed that I've been doing in this transaction? What have I been doing?
Asking questions.
The only thing that I did was ask questions. It looks like I'm not selling it. Because if the only thing I'm doing is asking questions, the other side has to come up with what they want and where they're at as far as price, time, effort, those kind of things. Once we can get them in a position and we can put me in a position, we can see if we can meet. But we have to find those two positions. Those two positions have to be outlined as quickly as. Because if we don't get them as clear as quickly as, then it's over. I talked to a friend of mine recently who's doing a development up north, and he bought a house on a block and a house on a block, and he's bulldozed one house and he's built 11 units around it and done a reno on the other one, so he'll have 12 for sale on the two blocks. And somebody down the road came up and said, are you interested in mine? It's down on the corner. So that person who had the corner block comes up and says, do you want to have a look at mine? It's the same size, blah, 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 blah. I know what you paid for these because it's now a registered deal. I want the same. And my friend said, I'm never going to get there price-wise. In other words, the beginning of the negotiation was, the person comes up and says, I saw you bought those two. Do you want this one for the same? And they're only like 100 metres apart from each other. So the same money would have been right. So he says, I'm never going to get to where you want. Think about that statement. I'm never going to get to that because I'm tied up with these. By the time I build these 11 units and do the reno, I'm in for a couple of million bucks, so I don't have what you want for your block. But what's he said, really?
I'm not interested.
He hasn't said that.
No. You need to.
He said, I'm not getting there at the money that you're talking about, which is fair price, because...
It just doesn't work for him for whatever reason.
Sorry?
It's just not working for him for whatever reason.
He says, it's just not working for me. I just can't do it. But what he said was, I'm never going to get there. Would you take 10% less? So he said, I could get to 90%. He said, well, what I could, and they said, no, we need the same, blah, 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 blah. He said, well, I wish I could get there, but I just can't, it's just stretching me too much. In other words, he's been very friendly, he's been very straightforward, he's been very open. He said, but, so I could offer you 90% and I could settle by the end of the week. So what's that bit? But I could settle by the end of the week.
Taking a lot of the time out of it.
Effectively, he's taking the time out, but what's he actually done in terms of...
That's a counter-offer that has a benefit for the other side.
In other words, what he's saying is, we can't meet on the price until you drop the price, but in exchange for you dropping the price, I will
give you...
Does that make sense? What that means is to settle by the end of the week, he has to forego all the inspections and all of the whatevers. He doesn't care about the inspections because if it's full of termites, that's not going to be a problem because he's looked at it and it's getting bulldozed anyway. I said to him, what do you know, but the termites could get you. And he goes, well, that'd be good, mate. Said, if it falls down, it's safe me knocking it down. Yeah. So does that make sense? It's kind of like, where are you, is there a way?
Because that side's asking for money doesn't mean that money is the only thing that needs to be involved in the exchange that will give them the same value.
But they start there. Most people start with the money and say, I need the cash. What these people were saying was, no, we need the cash because, and you understand they need when they say they need the cash, they've got it worked out in their head. That's because we've got to give the bank that much. We need this for a new car. We need that from, and we have to move to a new place. So they've gone, we need blah, blah, blah. In other words, we value what we've got based on what we need, not what it's worth.
There's a reluctance by some people, including me probably, about being dishonest in a negotiation.
Yep.
Stating what your outcome is, but you know that that's not really what you want or what's, but you're starting off with a lie, if you like. Is that a resistance to the sudden
process? I think for your average person, it's a roadblock. It's like a brick wall. I don't think that we want to go into situations and say, I want to start here because I want to get there. Sorry?
That just annoys me no end.
Yeah, I'd recommend you stay away from it. So my friend...
I sold property and I said to the real estate agent, don't talk to me until you tell me that you've got a cheque for $400,000. And he kept coming back going, we've got this. I'm going, what part of don't talk to me until you got $400,000 in your hand or in the deal? Do mm-hmm. you not understand? It drove me insane. Mm-hmm. Wanted to start high, move this, discount that, all these things. Yeah. I'm going, no, can't stand it.
Yeah, nowadays you'll see a way around that is they say offers over $420,000. Pretty simple. What you'll find out there is that there's a higher level of sophistication than ever in the negotiation process. People are smart cookies now. They go into Just Jeans, try them on, go home and buy them online. So we've got smart and sophisticated people out there, and we need to act like they are. And one of the things you're going to find is just saying it how it is going to work for you. So when my friend said, I just can't get to where you want, but I can get to 90%, that's not a lie. He's just saying that's what I can do. But what I can also do is I can settle for cash. Does that make sense? Okay. Because what happens is most people say what they think is right and fair and what they need. But so these people needed their 100% of what they wanted for that block of land. Because why? We've already been through this. Because they've already spent it. Mm. Does that make sense? Okay. So they need it until they realise they're not going to get it. And then he says, but we'll get it to you quickly. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm with Rick. I'm saying in all cases, be 100% honest. Because you'll be better at doing what you're doing. There's all sorts of reasons for being honest, but the main one is because of how you feel.
That's, and yet my expectation when I walk into a dress shop, but you know, and into a lot of places where it's going to sell me something, I'm expecting bullshit, spiel, lies, crap, you know, ingenuous comment.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my expectation as a consumer.
Well, I'd reckon that most of us get our expectations.
Thanks.
And you could look at changing that expectation and then watch and see if it changes the result. Mm-hmm. Because if you expected just to meet honest people, if you expected just to meet people who were great and you'd love to invite them home for dinner, you're most likely going to bump into that kind of person. If you expect to be robbed and burgled, you're most likely going to be robbed and burgled. So a lot of what we get comes from our belief about how it is out there. Because what we do is we find evidence to prove that. So you can go into one of those shops and meet the person working in that shop. In the moment, that's the only moment in her life she ever told a lie. Is that possible?
No.
It's possible. What I'm saying is that our life feeds us evidence that proves what's already set up here as our belief pattern. I'm suggesting that the healthiest thing that you can do is look at the belief pattern and ask yourself, is that serving you? Mm-hmm. Maybe it'd be good to change the belief pattern, because mm-hmm. we know that Mary Smith, a victim of domestic violence, expects to only meet violent men. She expects all relationships will turn violent if they're not now. Now, we've got to go out there and fix all the violent men, or have we actually got to fix Mary Smith's belief pattern? Both. Yeah, both, but yeah. We do have to teach violent men that there's another way. But if we're going to help Mary Smith right now, today, and she's the only one standing in front of us, what we need to do is help her change her belief or expectations. If she doesn't, the chances are
she's going to do it again.
It's going to, the behaviour is going to repeat. From that perspective, maybe this is what Rick is getting at. I reckon your character, the substance of who you are, is actually the most persuasive thing about you. People can smell it. People can smell whether you're telling the truth or not. Whether they smell it, whether they sense it, however they do that. But this idea that your character is your greatest asset is not a new idea. Aristotle wasn't born this century. He actually goes back a fair way. So this concept that you can be persuasive if you be authentic is what we're going to work on. The main reason is the easiest for you to do, but you're going to be most comfortable. Got that? Okie doke. So I'm going to lean heavily on some influential work, some groundbreaking work. I'm going to recommend that you get yourself a copy of Robert Cialdini's book, Cialdini or Cialdini, depending on how you want to pronounce it. So Influence, The Psychology of Persuasion, is probably a groundbreaking piece of work. I'm going to quote from it today. You probably won't need to read the book by the time that I've finished. However, I'm going to suggest that it would be great to have in your library, because I'm going to skip across the tips of the iceberg. What he does is give you all the reasons why and all of the parts of it that go together. So Cialdini's work is groundbreaking in terms of how things are not quite what they seem in terms of how you influence situations. I'm also going to refer to some work done by a guy called Daniel Pink. He's got two books out at the moment. I think his third book is on the way. He started with his book called Drive, which is the kind of book that you could just open at any page. You could actually literally just fan through the pages and open it and find something worth reading that's rivetingly interesting. And then he came out with To Sell Is Human. So I'm going to recommend both of those books. Drive is the kind of book you can read for 5 minutes. To Sell Is Human has got some structure about it, whatever. In Drive, he tells a fascinating story. A daycare centre in somewhere in Sweden was having issues with parents turning up on time to pick up their children. And there are all sorts of issues revolving around insurance and responsibility and those kind of things. And they're at a point where they had to close the doors and the kids had to be outside. And then there's a question of who's responsible for them and whatever. So to get the parents to turn up on time, what they did was that they instituted a fine system, and it was an escalating scale of fees. In other words, it was $1 for the first minute, but it was $2 for the second minute, and it was $4 for the third minute, and it was an escalating scale of a fine that you had to pay. They found that people turning up late doubled. Can any of you explain why? Because the expectation is speeding fines get people to slow down. The expectation is doing harm causes change in behaviour. So these fines cause a change in behaviour, all right? What happened was the late rate doubled. Twice as many people were late for double the length of time. Instead of being 5 minutes late, they were 10 minutes late, but there was twice as many of them who were doing it. Any explanation as to why? Because, see, you think when you give your kid a belting, they're not going to do that again.
Did
you
give them permission to do it? Because it was available as an option to
buy? It's close. Have another guess. Someone have another guess. It's like that. It's so much
because
like that.
Because then they value the 15 minutes late versus the $5 fee, and you go, yeah, I'll be 15 minutes late, this is more important here. And
basically what it boiled down was people said, bugger it, I'll just pay the fine. So they've got a meeting going on, they've got a telephone conversation happening, they've got something that's important at work that they can't just leave, or a deadline, mostly with deadlines, then what they'll go is, bugger it, I'll just have to pay. And what it meant was they were twice as late, but there was twice as many people doing it based on, well, bugger it, we'll just pay. Which puts a sword to the idea that people are worried about the price of anything. Fascinating concept, isn't it? When we look at it, you think that, you know, we buy things because they're cheaper. The reality is we'll buy time at any price. And that's just one of the things that I found in Drive when I was flicking through it one day while I was waiting for a client to turn up or something. 5 minutes. And what it made me realise was price is elastic. What the price is dependent on what is the benefit, not how much is the money. So I'm going to recommend that book just because it's insanely interesting and useful stuff. To Sell as Human is structured about the sales process. The other book I'm going to recommend to you is we were talking about before we started our live stream today, and that's The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck by Mark Manson. He's just come out with his new book. He's actually on tour at the moment with his new book called Everything is Fucked. And I'm going to recommend his blog. It's a good read. He has two levels. The free blog comes to your email probably two or three times a week, and he'll tell you what's in the paid blog. It's a pretty interesting ad for the paid blog, which is a much longer article on whatever it is that he's talking about. Fascinating thing to read, though. Really good stuff. His paid blog is like $5 a month or some ridiculously small thing for the value. Of course, he's got hundreds of thousands of people who have signed up to it, so he's an incredibly successful, wealthy author based on the idea of making himself useful. Daniel Pink, by the way, is a former scriptwriter for... What's his name, Darl? Al Gore. Yeah, so very kind of switched on and... latest thing. So I'm going to lead heavily on their work, but I suggest you buy the book. I think the greatest way to reward an author for their work is go and buy their book. So I'd recommend you buy those books and you just read them when you can. So here's an exercise for you. If you were to open your email system and go to the sent tab, so you went to the tab in your emails that said, okay, these emails I've sent out, then how many of those emails are either a request for somebody to do something, an instruction on what needs to be done, a question about progress, a report, or anything meant to influence or persuade, you know, meaning I need you to do this, or could you please look at, or whatever. What do you reckon would be the percentage of your sent emails that are meant to influence or persuade?
100?
100,
isn't it?
100? Okay. So I opened my email and said, okay, let's have a look at this. So I just screenshotted this sort of thing. I reckon it's close to 100%, but if you look at who's in my sent emails, I've sent stuff to myself, which we shouldn't count. That's because I'm transferring it from the laptop to the desktop. And for me, it's quicker to do that than it is to get a memory stick. Oh, so
you transfer it from here.
An email to Paul Blackburn is from my laptop to my thing. But if you look at these, then basically the ones where I'm requesting something, the ones where I'm asking somebody to do something, pretty much boil down to 8 out of those 11 that you can see there. For me, 72%, if you don't count me influencing me. If you took mine out, I'm probably like here. It's probably like 100%. So a lot of our communication every day is designed to influence and persuade. In fact, summaries of this stuff say, people who do the studies on what people do all the time, say that if you've got a partner, like a full-time, like live-in partner, that used to be wife or husband, but I have to say, significant other. Okay, so if you have a significant other, and you have a job, and you have one child, then you're going to spend 67% of your day influencing or persuading or pushing incomes. What that really means is that your main job in your life is in the sales department of your life.